Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning are Miriam Holly and Jeffrey McIntyre, authors of You and Your Partner, Inc., entrepreneurial couples succeeding in business, life, and love. Miriam was also a co-author of the incredibly successful Our Bodies, Ourselves book and its successors. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I went to see the number one movie in America now, which is, believe it or not, Man of Steel, the latest incarnation of Superman. I have to admit that I'm not at heart an admirer of superhero movies. I've never much liked them and don't get into the franchises they create. Iron Man, Wolverine, Batman, Spider-Man, even the superhero version of Sherlock Holmes, played by Robert Downey Jr., all have failed to impress me or even interest me very much. This 3D version of the Superman myth wasn't much better or worse than its many predecessors, to be honest. It worked, and it introduced yet another generation of teens to the notion that the world could be saved by a being from another planet who is really strong and fast, or is the result of some kind of genetic mutation or radiation leak or childhood trauma combined with all of those to create a being with superpowers and a really good costume tailor. The notion that we will be saved from world destruction repeatedly by a guy wearing tights and a cape or a weird mask along with him strikes me as very peculiar indeed. But while I simply can't get excited about superhero movies, I have to admit that this is a deficiency in a rabbi, since the whole concept of comic books and superheroes was created by Jews. There's an interesting scene in this particular version of the movie in which Superman, somewhat still undercover, walks into a church and seeks counsel and advice from a minister. It's a clever interpolation, but particularly surprising since Superman and frankly the whole comic book industry that was its home was a Jewish enterprise. Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster were two kids from Cleveland, Ohio, who had the concept for Superman, reworked it, tried to market it unsuccessfully for quite a while, and finally saw it fly to the top of the all-time comic book superhero pantheon and stay there ever since. There were two motivations for this. First, we Jews came up with the concept of the golem, a kind of primitive superhero created out of clay and Kabbalah by a great rabbi to protect the Jewish community when it was going to be attacked. Nobody knows when the first golem story circulated, but the most famous of them, the Golem of Prague, was attributed to the great rabbinic sage the Maharal of Prague in the 16th century. The legend became the source of many other super being tales that descended from it. Some dark and negative, like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, warning about human overreach, others more positive in depiction, like Superman. In the case of the Golem stories, the idea was that Jews were nearly powerless in those days in the face of anti-Semitism and race hatred and religious bigotry, and a being of superhuman strength and durability was needed to defend us. In earlier centuries, when we were subject to pogroms and the attack of the Cossacks and mobs, that was a golem. In the 1930s, faced with the rise of Hitler, Shuster and Siegel came up with Superman. We desperately needed a hero then, a champion, and one who could do more than any mortal being would be able to do. Also, the hero had to be, like Jews in those days, an outsider, a stranger in a strange land. Thus, Superman. The second reason Jews were so instrumental in the development of the comic book industry, based as it is on superheroes, is that the regular standard publishing houses were highly anti-Semitic in those days and simply wouldn't publish Jewish authors much. The art industry wasn't much better. So writers and artists had to turn to other places to find outlets for their creativity. if you can't get your novel published by the literary magazines and bookhouses, if you can't get anyone to put your art in their gallery or buy it for a museum or hire you to illustrate their high-toned magazine, then create your own magazine with pictures and cheap print and sell it even more cheaply. That was, in essence, the origin of the comic book industry. It was similar to the course Jews took in creating the movie industry in America. The better theaters and the opera and the symphony weren't conducive to Jewish participation in the early days of the 20th century, but a brand new arena for creative expression, like motion pictures, gave writers, actors, directors, producers, musicians, and artists the opportunity to make something magnificent, even if they were Jewish. And so the shidduch, the marriage between comic book superheroes and the movies, always expressed today in the form of summer blockbusters, was actually born out of Jewish necessity. The introduction of a church scene into this latest iteration of that series is particularly anomalous. I would have vastly preferred that Superman consult a rabbi in the film, a far more likely choice based on his creators, Siegel and Shuster. Of course, just where would you find a shul in Smallville? So I guess I'll just have to suppress my distaste for superheroes, because they are essentially Jewish creations. For me, there's a kind of a food analogy. It's like the classic Ashkenazic dish tzimmus. I actually can't stand it, but I know it's Jewish, and I just have to eat it. At least once in a while. So on the superhero front, I'll restrict myself to Superman this year. To play us in on this hot morning, here's a cool song from the Jews of Yemen, Samuni no Tera, using a text from the Song of Songs. It's called Keeper of the Vineyards, a beautiful love song from the Bible, from the CD Neve Midbar by Leah Abraham.
Samuni no Tera, Samuni no Tera, Samuni, hoy no Tera et akramim, Samuni no Tera, Samuni. Samuni, oy no tera et akramim, kumilach, kumilach raayati kumi, oy afati ulchilach, kumilach, kumilach raayati kumi, oy afati ulchilach, ki hine hasta vine avar, ki hine hageshem echalav halach lo, ki hine hasta vine avar, ki hine hageshem מחלף הלך לו קומי לך קומי לך רעייתי קומי אוי יפתי ולחילך קומי לך קומי לך רעייתי קומי אוי יפתי ולחילך
That was the lovely Samuni no Tera from the Yemenite Jews and Leah Avraham, Keeper of the Vineyards. When we come back on Too Jewish This Morning, we'll meet our guests, Miriam Hawley, the co-founder and author of Our Bodies, Ourselves, the highly influential book that changed the way American women thought about their own bodies and their sexuality, and her husband, Jeffrey McIntyre, with whom she's written a great book helping entrepreneurial couples succeed in life. Find out how that's possible when we come back on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great. It's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a bid price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guests this morning, Miriam Hawley and Jeffrey McIntyre. Miriam Hawley is perhaps best known for, I don't know, is writing a fair way of describing Our Bodies
Founder
Ourselves?
Founder and original co-author.
Of Our Bodies Ourselves, which has gone through many editions and been translated into multiple languages and is still, it was originally perhaps the seminal book on women's health written by women about women and sexuality, and it has still has a tremendous amount of importance internationally. They are engaged in a remarkable project. You and your partner, Entrepreneurial Couples Succeeding in Business, Life, and Love, is their newest book, and have a consulting firm and do a very important work. Good morning and welcome. Miriam, Tikkun Olam is a central Jewish idea, reworking the world, improving the world, fixing the world. Can you talk a little bit about its influence in your family and your life?
Well, I would say it was the religion growing up, that my parents, both Jewish by background, were not religiously Jewish, but they were culturally Jewish and practiced tikkun olam. And social justice, the way I've put it in the past, is or put it here, is that social justice was really the religion of the family. Music, it was very important. My father was a folk singer by avocation, and you know, Pete Seeger and Paul Robeson were, you know, household names.
Acting out Tikkun Olam in today's world takes a variety of different forms.
Yeah.
You guys deal with the question of sufficiency, and that certainly seems to me to be related to Tikkun Olam. You know, what's enough, and when does trying to get too much damage the world itself?
The conversation about sufficiency and what is enough is really central to Tikkun Olam. It's whether it's enough what you consume, or you know, enough energy or enough time to do the things that are important to you. But sufficiency was a conversation that was introduced to me in the late 90s. By a man named Les Traban. What I learned from him, and he became one of my really important mentors, is that you take a stand for what you can contribute to the world. Sufficiency is what you can give, and then out of your giving, that goes back to the world.
Well, we will talk much more about sufficiency. Jeffrey, I promise you'll get a chance to say something with Miriam Hawley and Jeffrey McIntyre when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming them from there, or download our very popular podcasts at iTunes. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy, good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You head back to Israel in not very long. We spoke last week a little bit about some observations you had about the American Jewish community, the need for Judaism to compete in this great marketplace of ideas, and more than that, of habits and practices and educational experiences and other experiences available to kids, and how difficult that can be. Let's talk a little bit from the other perspective. You're going back to Israel, and people now see Israel as becoming increasingly Americanized, with malls, with many of the same elements that are so popular in American society. This is the Jewish state. It's supposed to be unique. What can you tell us about your observations in that direction?
I think one of the most interesting phenomena in the arena of Jewish identity in Israel is what might be perceived as an underground battle between threads in Israel. The classical split in Israel was a split between the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredi, and the secular Jews. Of course, that's a little rough description because you also have the Kippah Sruga, the national Orthodox, but it was between
modern Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox for those American perspectives, right? The knit kippah as opposed to the velvet kippah, exactly.
Right. But still it was Orthodox versus secular. And secular, it was secular in the Israeli style, a secular that does observe holy days, might do a kiddush on Friday, might go
some
to synagogue from
dinners,
time to time.
Right. Not so secular by American standards, but by Israeli standards, sure.
But by Israeli standards, it's secular mainly because it's not praying three times a day. The element of faith was less significant and so on and so forth. What we do see in the last several years is an increased number of new movements that come from a different approach of saying, you know what, we can be secular and still engage with the Hebrew bookshelf, with the Talmud, with the Tanakh, with the rabbinic books, and engage with them from a different, maybe more modern perspective. We also see effects of American Jewry on elements of women's place within Jewish life, equality, taking off the boundaries in synagogues, more conservative shuls, more reform shuls, and new movements like Bet Tfilah Israeli in Tel Aviv and other places. That's a very interesting phenomenon, and it's a big question, where will it go? It's a very big question.
It's an interesting question also for an American Jew to feel comfortable in a synagogue or in a religious setting in Israel. And that's also been part of the continued development of a somewhat growing reform movement, a somewhat growing Masorati conservative movement. Israelis and Americans who have moved there looking at Israel and Judaism there in a different way, too. It'll be interesting for you once you go back there and where you're going to fit into that continuum. But we can talk about that next week. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You were talking about the Syrian civil war last week and what a mess it is. I think people don't really understand the composition of Syria as a country, its ethnic divisions. Can we explore that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, when we left off last week, I think you had just raised the complexity of all the different factions in the opposition, the pro-Islamists, the anti-Islamists, whatever. I mean, one thing that few people understand, I think, is that the regime, and particularly the ruling family, the Assad family, right, over the past couple of generations has been drawn from a tiny minority group called the Alawites. Some traditional Muslims don't even consider Alawites to be Muslims at all. Others consider them to be heterodox or heretical Muslims. But they certainly don't fall easily into the category of Shia or Sunni. And Syria has always been a complicated patchwork, like Lebanon, of Christians of different churches. Traditionally, there was an important Jewish community, in Damascus and in Aleppo. There was an important Armenian community. Now, most of those communities have dwindled away, and what's left are Druze, Alawites, and, let's say, more mainstream Muslims. But no rest for the wicked in terms of political analysis, in terms of how this minority has maintained power over much of the past half century. It's used a variety of coercive tricks, corruption, authoritarianism, secret police. And the one time I visited Damascus was on like a school trip with the École Nationale d'Administration, the National Administration School in France. And we were theoretically guests of the government. We came from the French Prime Minister's office. We were very well treated. We had a meeting with the foreign minister. We had a lovely reception in the residence of the French ambassador, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. But I had to say, it felt like we were in a police state. I mean, there were soldiers everywhere, people in uniform, almost nobody on the streets at night. It was as scary and as palpably oppressive as the Soviet Union was in the time of Brezhnev.
Wow.
So it felt ripe for revolution. And I mean, it's interesting that it seems to be one of the last countries struck by the winds of the so-called Arab Spring. I would have expected it to be one of the first, except for the fact that the regime has been so repressive and people have been so afraid for so long.
You know, people think that just because it's a repressive regime, that it'll be an effective regime. That isn't always the case. But the Assads spent far more time protecting their power than they did developing Syria or worrying about Syria's external threats. I think particularly since 73, they really haven't dealt with external threats. They've just been working on their own stuff.
Absolutely.
And it's kept them in power. Well, we'll see for how much longer. Thanks, Tom. Important for Israel, important for the Middle East, important in a way for the whole world.
Absolutely.
Talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two astronauts land on Mars. Their mission is to determine whether there's oxygen on the planet. "Look, it's simple," one astronaut says over his spacesuit radio. "Give me the box of matches. Either it burns and there's oxygen or nothing happens." So the astronaut takes the box. He's ready to strike a match when out of the blue, a Martian appears waving all of his seven arms. "No, no, don't." The astronauts look at each other, worried. Could there be an unknown explosive gas on Mars? Still, the astronaut takes the match and prepares to strike it. Suddenly, a crowd of hysterical Martians come, all waving their many arms and shouting, "No, please, no, don't do that. Stop, please." The astronaut says, "Look, this looks serious. Still, we're here for science, to know if humans could breathe on Mars." So he strikes the match. It flames up, burns down. Nothing happens. So he turns to the Martians and says, "Why didn't you want us to strike a match?" And the leader of the Martians says, "Today is Shabbos." You see, Shabbos is Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath, and Orthodox Jews don't light matches on... Never mind. That was the old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature Too Jewish Just for You. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Matot and Maaseh, the last sections of the Book of Numbers, Bamidbar. Both portions teach an important message about the centrality of Jewish family values, but they do so in very different ways. The setting for these final parshiot in Numbers is the border of the Promised Land as the Israelites approach Canaan for a second time, after their 40-year sojourn in the wilderness of Sinai. As the tribes gather to enter the land, two of them, Reuben and Gad, make a strange request for Moses. "We like the land we're traveling through now, here on the east bank of the Jordan," what is today the country of Jordan, long before the Arab peoples moved into the Middle East. The leaders of Reuben and Gad say, "Let us stay here on the east bank of the Jordan and build sheepfolds for our flocks and towns for our children." And Moses agrees, but in interesting language. First he tells them, "Build the towns for your children to protect them. Then build sheepfolds for your flocks." The message is clear. Our families come first, our professions and income second. It's a human message and one that we need to relearn in every generation, sometimes every year. Put family first. There's another great family message in the doubled portions this week, but this one has to do with what happens when things go badly wrong. In the very last section of Numbers, Maaseh, an important and unusual institution is created, the City of Refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts were common, justice for manslaughter or murder was accomplished by the family of the victim. Vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption created by killing. If you killed someone, intentionally or accidentally, or even if the family of a person who was killed just thought you'd committed it, you would likely be killed yourself by their kinsmen. Which meant that if you were involved in such a terrible situation, you had very little chance to remain alive, even if the killing was an accident, even if you were completely innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, it wouldn't help much. This kind of reprisal killing also could and did lead to cycles of revenge, the sort of blood feud that Mark Twain captured, describing the Hatfields and the McCoys several millennia later, the kind of clan murdering that takes place even today in the Palestinian Arab towns in the West Bank and Gaza. To preclude this social disaster in the portion of Maaseh, the Torah provides six cities of refuge. We are to create them in and around the land of Israel. No person who enters these cities may be executed without a fair trial. Being present in the city of refuge is a kind of protection, the guarantee of due process that has become central in modern law, but was mostly absent throughout human history. Yet the Torah established that principle some 3,000 years ago. Whether it did so to protect innocents accused of murder or simply to keep families from falling into cycles of revenge, the message was clear. The most basic unit of society must be nurtured, maintained, and protected. Its positive values strengthened always in even the most trying situations. A great message for us today. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guests, Miriam Hawley, the co-author of the groundbreaking Our Bodies Ourselves, and her husband and co-author, Jeffrey McIntyre, will explain how couples can flourish in entrepreneurial work as well as in life and love, and tell us how to do it. Find out when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Gary David Goldberg, a writer and producer who created warm-hearted TV shows, most notably Family Ties, a leading comedy of the 80s that propelled Michael J. Fox to stardom, died last week. Goldberg was 68 years old.
I think the legacy is family matters. Family is important. And you know what? Why it's always, you can't get away from your family. That's why it's one of the great comic institutions, because there's no safe, you can't get away. There's no outlet. They're always your family. You know, respect the differences, you know, tolerate the differences, and the path through is love and respect. That's the only way to succeed.
Gary David Goldberg came to writing late after a peripatetic young adulthood in the 60s and early 70s that included dropping out of colleges, waiting tables in Greenwich Village, hitchhiking around the world, and starting a daycare center in Northern California. The rebellious flower child sensibility that informed those adventures was the spur for Family Ties that captured the culture clash between parents of the hippie generation and their children growing up during the Reagan administration. If you don't remember the show, and you should, it was quite good. It was on NBC from 82 to 89. It was set in Columbus, Ohio, in a suburb, and it was about a family called the Keatons. Stephen and Elise, played by Michael Gross and Meredith Baxter Burney, and their children, Alex, played by Michael J. Fox, a bright young Republican with a hunger for money, the fashion-obsessed airhead Mallory, their daughter, played by Justine Bateman, and Jennifer, played by Tina Yothers, who didn't matter. The pilot episode opened with the Keatons in their living room watching home movies of the dad and mom at a demonstration against the Vietnam War. That was history in the making, Mom explains. There were people from every state in the Union at that protest. What were you protesting, Alex, the son asks. Good grooming? Originally meant to focus on the parents, based on Gary David Goldberg and his own wife, the show became a vehicle for Michael J. Fox. He was 19 when it started. He soon captured the lead role not only in the TV show, but in the 1985 hit Back to the Future and its sequels. Michael J. Fox was not actually the first choice for Family Ties. Matthew Broderick was. And even after his audition, Gary David Goldberg did not want him for the part. It was only after the casting director, Judith Wiener, pestered Goldberg to see Michael J. Fox again that the match was made. Family Ties reversed the All in the Family sitcom pattern of liberal kids arguing with conservative parents. On Family Ties, the conservative Michael J. Fox character was in constant dialogue with his much more liberal parents. Well, and society as well.
Okay, now, we're going to need a business manager to help us avoid paying taxes.
What's taxes?
A tax is a terrible, hairy, liberal monster. With big teeth. The only thing that can stop the terrible tax monster is a Republican. Who wants to be a Republican?
What made the show a success was that differences among the family members were settled in a loving manner. Like the Cosby Show's Huxtables, that came along a couple seasons later, this was a happy family. I was interested in the dynamic of a couple that had been together long term and were still active and attracted to each other, a house where there was romance, where the parents' relationship to the kids reflected expanded lanes of communication, represented the way families were changing, Goldberg said in 2007. This father was not threatened by the growing power of his children. They were trying to have a relationship that would continue in the future. His goal was not to show how he could control and coerce the kids. It was ruling by love. The power of love kept everybody together. And respect, which is even more powerful than fear. I wanted to show these elements. Goldberg, who was of course Jewish, there are very few non-Jewish Goldbergs you'll find, grew up in Bensonhurst and said that anything that happened to me that's good really goes back to Brooklyn and to my grandmother's apartment. Gary David Goldberg played basketball at Lafayette High, won an athletic scholarship to Brandeis, but didn't finish, eventually graduating from San Diego State. In 1969, he was a waiter in Manhattan when he met Diana Meehan, a flight attendant. They spent 14 months traveling together, mostly penniless, accompanied by their dog. When they got back, they started that daycare center in Berkeley. After 2 years, they moved to Southern California, where, at San Diego State, a writing teacher helped Goldberg get jobs in television. He wrote for The Bob Newhart Show, was a producer on Lou Grant, starring Ed Asner, former guest of Too Jewish, by the way, and The Tony Randall Show. Goldberg created other shows after Family Ties, most notably Brooklyn Bridge, which lasted a couple of seasons in the 90s, and then Spin City, which reunited him with Michael J. Fox, playing the deputy mayor of New York. Spin City lasted 6 seasons, 96 to 2002, the last of which featured Charlie Sheen in place of Michael J. Fox.
What did you think I would do at this moment when you're standing before me with tears in your eyes trying to tell me you found you another? You just don't love me.
Gary's work is a celebration of life, of relationships, of small family moments, Fox said shortly before Goldberg's death. I used to marvel at what brought him to this place of gentle, loving humor, this jock from Brooklyn who could craft this stuff. Maybe it was because he was Jewish. In other news, American television host Jon Stewart took his politically engaged satire to Cairo, Egypt, last week, appearing on a show hosted by the man known as Egypt's Jon Stewart, who has faced investigation for insulting the president and Islam in Egypt. Among barbs aimed at Egypt's ruling Islamists and others, Stewart praised host Bassem Youssef for taking risks and poking fun. If your regime is not strong enough to handle a joke, Stewart said, you don't have a regime. Youssef is a cardiologist whose online comedy clips inspired by Stewart's The Daily Show won him wild popularity in a primetime TV show after the 2011 revolution that ended military rule. He paid tribute to his guest as a personal inspiration as the pair traded gags over Stewart's impressions of a visit to Cairo. Stewart, in turn, played down any difficulties his wit created for him in the U.S., telling Youssef, I tell you this, it does not get me into the kind of trouble it gets you into. I get in trouble, but nowhere near what happens to you. With Egypt in ferment and elected Islamist President Mohamed Morsi facing off against liberals who fear he plans to smother personal freedoms, Youssef was arrested and then later released on bail after being questioned over alleged insults to Morsi back in March. The TV channel he appears on was threatened with losing its license. Criticizing such moves, which have also drawn reproaches for Egypt from the U.S. government, Jon Stewart said, a joke has never shot tear gas at a group of people in a park. It's just talk. What Bassem is doing here in Egypt is showing that satire can still be relevant, that it can carve out a space in a country for people to express themselves, because that's all democracy is. As a shtick, Jon Stewart was brought into the Egyptian TV studio hooded and presented as a spy, and then spoke a few words in Arabic. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews around the world.
We're delighted to welcome back the Too Jewish, our guests this morning, Miriam Hawley and Jeffrey McIntyre. They have written together, You and Your Partner, Inc., entrepreneurial couple succeeding in business, life, and love. They do a great deal of consulting with individuals and companies. Miriam Holly is best known for her founding of the Boston Women's Health Book Collective, which created Our Bodies, Ourselves. For some of us, for many people all around the world, actually, a seminal book created by women, about women, and about women's sexuality in a very different and unusual way for the time, really still unusual. Going back into history, we talked about Tikkun Olam a little bit. Can you talk about the evolution of Our Bodies, Ourselves, how that book, how that whole process came about? It's an old story for you now.
Well, it's an old story. It came out of my activism, which started in my family, in terms of being concerned about social justice and being involved, you know, through my college years in New Left politics and the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement.
I think SDS came up in some of your bios.
Yes. I was in Michigan with Judy Gomez, who is, you know, my friend who brought us to Tucson, and we met. SDS came to Michigan in 1960 when we both were there. So that was a home base for, you know, other social justice activists. And
this is the pre-violent Student for a Democratic Society.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Our Bodies, Ourselves, when I moved to Boston from Cambridge, Boston, in the mid-60s, and in that process, there was just beginning to really look at our role as women in SDS and role of women in just in the world.
And in the civil rights movement in particular.
And in the civil rights movement, women were very important in the civil rights movement. They were behind Martin Luther King Jr.
And from Rosa Parks on out.
From Rosa Parks on out. So there was a lot more consciousness just popping up. You know, movements happen because there's a kind of energy in different places that starts to come together. And Boston was one of the places it came together. And I was involved in helping to create the women's movement there, helped to sponsor the first women's conference. And in that women's conference, it was May 4th, 1969, to give you a time frame.
Approximately.
And I had my second child, who was 3 weeks old, my daughter at that time. And I did a workshop called Control of Their Bodies. And the language is important in terms of, you know, kind of our owner, you know, kind of coming into ownership of our own bodies and
sure.
our own lives. And out of that came interest. You know, the room was packed and was part of a conference on different topics, on politics, on women's self-exams, and on health. And out of that conference came a lot of interest from people about continuing the conversation. That summer, we put together, a group of us chose different topics around women's health and sexuality that were interesting to us and came together in a lounge at MIT, because I had access to space at MIT, and presented a course that we just gave to other women, expecting that people would take it back to their temples, their churches, their child care centers, their homes, and share the information. And people did that and wanted papers, wanted copies of the material. And it was free shareware. And, you know, eventually, you know, I can go into more details, but eventually what happened is we were requested, like, we need a book. So we raised the money, $1,500.
$1,500
at the time. We raised the money and put together a book and had it published by the New England Free Press, who almost didn't publish it because it wasn't radical enough. And that was the beginning. And then we sold 200,000 copies by word of mouth. People laughed at me when I said, we're going to sell 1 million copies. But I said, look, every woman has a body, and every man who loves a woman will be interested in this, too. And so we have sold 5 million, and it's been translated or adapted into 30 different language or format editions around the world, and new editions are still coming out. So we have
really an extraordinary accomplishment.
We have transformed the global conversation about women's health and sexuality, and we didn't do it alone. You know, we were in collaboration with lots and lots of people and lots of women's groups, and lots of people over the years have contributed to the book. I think it offers an opportunity. You know, I'm proud of what we've done, mm-hmm. and of the contribution we've made. I'm also proud of the model that we have created, that can be that anybody who has an idea, a concern, can and really wants to enlarge in the conversation can do the same thing.
You know, it's an amazing accomplishment. Really, you didn't do it to make a lot of money selling books, you know, and it wasn't following any of the normal publishing channels, and there was a certain freedom in the late 60s, early 70s where people were trying to do things, but that doesn't mean most of them accomplished it. So I think in terms of changing the way that people spoke about women, I remember reading you're saying that, you know, when people talked about women, it was always in the third person, and it was always
their bodies,
right? And women weren't supposed to think about their bodies as our bodies. So just the very title transformed the way the conversation worked. So how do you go from that extraordinary work, which is still ongoing, and that's really one of the beautiful things about it, to carrying forward Tikkun Olam in some other areas?
Well, I'm going to talk about our new book and let Jeffrey talk about it too, saying there were three themes in Our Bodies, Ourselves. One is knowledge is power, trusting your own personal experience, and having a systemic view, or, you know, a larger economic and political view of the world. And I think in the work with you and your partner, Inc., those same three threads come together, this time for business, life, and love. And for couples in business. And also the fourth thread in You and Your Partner, Inc. that's different than Our Bodies, Ourselves is that the couples we interviewed, and we interviewed 50 couples around the country, all sorts of different businesses and all sorts of different backgrounds and size of organizations. The fourth thread is we're offering a new model for doing business, of people not just bringing their self to their relationships and their business, but bringing their whole selves to their whole lives. And that is sorely needed in corporate America as well as in family business or couple-run business.
This connection just took place the other day. This book is constantly kind of nurturing different ideas that aren't even written in the book. They sort of rise out of the context of the conversation between Miriam and I, and when we're having conversations like this. One of those connections is the whole idea of partnership and what does it mean to be really partnered with somebody. How do you, you know, there's a lot of business models of that, but we're starting to explore it at a level of male and female energies, even if there's a gay couple. Just, you know what, we have all sorts of backgrounds of people we interviewed. But the most important part of it, as far as I can tell, was the whole way that it became. I said this to Miriam, I said, it's really a conversation about ending alienation. What's the way we could find to bring this forward that people can not be alienated from their labor, not be alienated from their work, but can be really connected to it, and because they're connected to all the relationships in a very intimate and personal way.
Let's make them heterosexual, just for the sake of this conversation. Mm-hmm. Are going into business together, entrepreneurially. They decide they want to start something. What are the most obvious beginning points that people should look at if they're going to do that? What kinds of ways should they be thinking about not only their relationship, but their relationship to their work and to the people with whom they work? Because business is relationships, really.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
There's a number of issues around, in terms of the issue of partnership, there's a number of issues connected to that about power, equality, contribution to the business, contribution to the development and management of the business. learning what specialty role, learning what roles people have and what's specialized about them and what's generic that either one of them could do.
How can they honor each other's strengths?
Right.
One of the things in You and Your Partner, Inc., across the couples we quote, people are looking for and honoring each other's strengths and in the business.
And another way of thinking about that was one couple of real examples of a variation of that from California, and they have a conversation, how can I contribute to your greatness today? That's the way they start their day. Pretty cool.
That's great.
Yeah. And they really mean it. They don't. It's not something faked or phony. They really want to know how to support each other's greatness and how to support each other's productivity, how to support each other's actions. A couple we're going to go up and be with in Boulder, same thing. These two couples didn't know each other until being involved in the quotes we chose to be in the book.
I think, you know, people need to be clear about why they start their business. Some people start it because they've inherited a business. Other people, it's very practical. And they're very clear that they want to spend time with their kids. They want to be available to go take their kids to their soccer games and their doctor's appointments, etc., to their religious school training.
Bar mitzvah, of course.
They want to be available while their kids are young, not after they've left home. And so people have visions and missions. You know, people have an entrepreneurial spirit and feel like they've always wanted to start a business or take over a family business. And one of the things that is really important for people is that they're good communicators and willing to communicate, if necessary, have conversations 24/7, and like being with their best friend around the clock. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what distinguished some of the couples. That's what distinguished the couples in our book that were successful, that people were interested and willing to be with one another and communicate. And the other thing is, when your income is dependent on your relationship working, you get off it really quickly with one another. And I think a lot of the couples in our book really teach other couples about how to shorten disagreements, fights.
One couple we interviewed that they're developing testing machines for making life in Africa medically more effective, because they do AIDS tests now in like 3 days or something.
Yeah.
And they have these fleet of trucks that travel all over Central Africa.
A huge issue in Africa.
But they have a thing where when they get really angry with each other, they just stop for 5 minutes and they say, is this fight worth ending our relationship? Is it that important that we, you know, get that down and dirty with each other, that we won't complete this, we'll just get divorced? And that's guided their thinking for, you know, 10 years, 15 years, as a way of handling conflicts and putting it in perspective. Is this worth ending our relationship over?
You know, I think we also come back to the issue of intentionality, or kavanah in Judaism, and that a lot of the couples we interviewed were very intentional about their purpose, their larger purpose in life, and really wanting to make a contribution. You know, we started out with Tikkun Olam. You know, they would be participating in Tikkun Olam and see that as part of doing business well.
You know, it's a great lesson. We don't tend to think about businesses as ways to create Tikkun Olam, and yet I think the notion of socially responsible businesses, sufficiency, some of these ideas are beginning to percolate through and maybe even beginning to transform the way business is done. I want to thank Miriam Hawley and Jeffrey McIntyre for a great visit. It feels much too brief.
Mm-hmm.
Book is called You and Your Partner, Inc., and it's available, on Amazon.
Right, and
what's the website?
People can go to our website, www.youandyourpartnerinc.com.
Youandyourpartnerinc.com. Thank you so much, and hopefully we'll do this again sometime.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Rabbi Joel Mosbacher, speaking about gun violence, telling us where we are now in the wake of so many shootings in our country in the past 12 months. Our playout this morning comes from the Sephardic singer Mor Karbasi, singing in Ladino. It's called La Hija de la Primavera, the young girl of the spring. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
La Hija de la Primavera no vive más entre de nosotros. Si ha ido a buscar el silencio, la vida.